Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the December 5th Sunday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today, we will be reading the following main articles. U.S.-Russia tensions, Biden-Putin to discuss Ukraine, by Dasha Litanova, Amar Madhani, and Colleen Long. Michigan school shooting, suspects' parents caught in Detroit, bail set at $1 million, by Kathleen Foody and Corey Williams. 2022 election, voting rights take center stage as GOP crafts bills, by Mick Corasaniti. Weather, metro area in extreme drought, first Front Range snowfall proves elusive. State gets mostly below-average precipitation levels, by Conrad Swanson, and following up with miscellaneous articles. U.S.-Russia tensions, Biden-Putin to discuss Ukraine, by Dasha Litanova, Amir Manhani, and Colleen Long, The Associated Press, by Line Moscow. Presidents Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin will speak in a video call Tuesday, the White House and Kremlin said, as tensions between the United States and Russia escalate over a Russian troop buildup on the Ukrainian border that's seen as a sign of a potential invasion. Biden will press U.S. concerns about Russian military activities on the border and reaffirm the United States' support for the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said Saturday, confirming the planned call after first word came from Moscow. Putin will come to the call with concerns of his own and intends to express Russia's opposition to any move to admit Ukraine to the NATO military alliance. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said the presidents will decide themselves how long their talk will last. The last known call between the leaders was in July, when Biden pressed Putin to rein in Russia-based criminal hacking gangs launching ransomware attacks against the United States. Biden said the U.S. would take any necessary steps to protect critical infrastructure from such attacks. Ransomware attacks have continued since then, although perhaps none has been as alarming as the one from May that targeted a major fuel pipeline and resulted in days of gas shortages in parts of the U.S. Russia is more adamant than ever that the U.S. guarantees that Ukraine will not be admitted to the NATO military alliance. But NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said this past week that Russia has no say in expansion plans by other countries or the alliance. Numerous former U.S. and NATO diplomats say any such Russian demand to Biden would be a non-starter. U.S. intelligence officials, meanwhile, have determined that Russia has massed about 70,000 troops near its border with Ukraine and has begun planning for a possible invasion as soon as early next year, according to a Biden administration official who was not authorized to discuss that finding publicly and spoke on the condition of anonymity. The risks for Putin of going through with such an invasion would be enormous. U.S. officials and former American diplomats say that although the Russian president is clearly laying the groundwork for a possible invasion, Ukraine's military is better armed and prepared today than in the past, and that sanctions threatened by the West would do serious damage to the Russian economy. What I am doing is putting together what I believe to be, will be, the most comprehensive and meaningful set of initiatives to make it very, very difficult for Mr. Putin to go ahead and do what people are worried he may do, Biden said Friday. Ukrainian officials have said Russia could invade next month. Ukraine's defense minister, Oleksiy Reznikov, said the number of Russian troops near Ukraine and a Russia-annexed Crimea is estimated at 94,300, and warned that a large-scale escalation is possible in January. Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, recently charged that a group of Russians and Ukrainians planned to attempt a coup in his country, and that the plotters tried to enlist the help of Ukraine's richest man, Rinat Akhmetov. Russia and Akhmetov have denied any plot is underway, but the Russians have become more explicit recently in their warnings to Ukraine and the United States. Biden is also expected to speak with Zelensky in the coming week, according to a source close to the Ukrainian leader. The Kremlin said Friday that Putin, during his call with Biden, would seek binding guarantees precluding NATO's expansion to Ukraine. Biden tried to head off the demand in comments to reporters Friday before leaving for a weekend stay at Camp David. "I don't accept anyone's red line," Biden said. Psaki said in a brief statement Saturday that Biden and Putin will discuss a range of topics in the U.S.-Russia relationship, including strategic stability, cyber, and regional issues. She said Friday that the administration would coordinate with European allies if it moved forward with sanctions. She alluded to Russia's 2014 annexation of Crimea, the Black Sea Peninsula that had been under Ukraine's control since 1954. Russia also has backed separatists in eastern Ukraine in a seven-year conflict that has cost more than 14,000 lives. Michigan school shooting. Suspect's parents caught in Detroit. Bail set at $1 million. By Kathleen Foody and Corey Williams, The Associated Press, byline, Pontiac, Michigan. A judge imposed a combined $1 million bail Saturday for the parents of the Michigan teen charged with killing four students at Oxford High School, hours after police said they were caught hiding in a Detroit commercial building. James and Jennifer Crumley entered pleas of not guilty to each of the four counts of involuntary manslaughter against them during a hearing on Zoom. Jennifer Crumley sobbed and struggled to respond to the judge's questions at times, and James Crumley shook his head when a prosecutor said their son had full access to the gun used in the killings. Judge Julie Nicholson assigned a bail of $500,000 apiece to each of the parents and required GPS monitoring if they pay to be released, agreeing with prosecutors that they posed a flight risk. Defense attorneys for the Crumleys still argued Saturday that they never intended to flee and had made plans to meet their lawyers early that morning. Attorney Shannon Smith accused prosecutors of cherry-picking facts to release publicly, including the accusation that their teenage son had unrestricted access to the handgun prosecutors say his father purchased for him days before the shooting. "Our clients are just as devastated as everyone else," Smith said, adding that the gun was locked. She didn't provide more detail during Saturday's hearing. Oakland County Prosecutor Karen McDonald's office filed charges of involuntary manslaughter against the Crumleys on Friday, accusing them of failing to intervene on the day of the tragedy, despite being confronted with a drawing and chilling message, "Blood Everywhere," that was found at the boys' desk. They could each face up to 15 years in prison, according to a spokeswoman for McDonald's office. The Crumleys committed egregious acts, from buying a gun on Black Friday to making it available to Ethan Crumley to resisting his removal from school when they were summoned a few hours before the shooting, McDonald said Friday. Authorities had been looking for the couple since Friday afternoon. Late Friday, U.S. Marshals announced a reward of up to $10,000 each for information leading to their arrests. Smith, the Crumley's attorney, had said Friday that the pair left town earlier in the week for their own safety and would be returning to Oxford to face charges. During Saturday's hearing, Smith said they were in touch by phone and text on Friday evening and blamed prosecutors for failing to communicate with her and fellow defense attorney Marielle Lehman. Our clients were absolutely going to turn themselves in. It was just a matter of logistics, she said. But McDonald said on Saturday that the couple took $4,000 out of an ATM on Friday morning in Rochester Hills, not far from the courthouse where they should have appeared that afternoon. These are not people that we can be assured will return to court on their own, she said. A Detroit business owner spotted a car tied to the Cremleys in his parking lot late Friday, Oakland County Undersheriff Michael McCabe said in a statement. A woman seen near the vehicle ran away when the business owner called 911, McCabe said. The couple was located and arrested by Detroit police. Detroit Police Chief James White said the couple were aided in getting into the building and that a person who helped them also may face charges. On Friday, McDonald offered the most precise account so far of the events that led to the shooting at Oxford High School, about 30 miles north of Detroit. Ethan Crumley, 15, emerged from a bathroom with a gun, shooting students in the hallway, investigators said. He is charged as an adult with murder, terrorism, and other crimes. Under Michigan law, the charge of involuntary manslaughter filed against the parents can be pursued if authorities believe someone contributed to a situation where there was a high chance of harm or death. Parents in the U.S. are rarely charged in school shootings involving their children, even as most minors get guns from a parent or relative's house, according to experts. School officials became concerned about the younger Crumley on Monday, a day before the shooting, when a teacher saw him searching for ammunition on his phone, McDonald said. Jennifer Crumley was contacted and subsequently told her son in a text message, LOL, I'm not mad at you. You have to learn not to get caught, according to the prosecutor. On Tuesday, a teacher found a note on Ethan's desk and took a photo. It was a drawing of a gun pointed at the words, "The thoughts won't stop. Help me," McDonald said. There also was a drawing of a bullet, she said, with words above it, "Blood everywhere." Between the gun and the bullet was a person who appeared to have been shot twice and is bleeding. He also wrote, "My life is useless," and "The world is dead," according to the prosecutor. The school had a meeting with Ethan and his parents, who were told to get him into counseling within 48 hours, McDonald said. The Crumleys failed to ask their son about the gun or check his backpack and resisted the idea of their son leaving the school at that time, McDonald said. Instead, the teen returned to class, and the shooting subsequently occurred. In a written statement released Saturday, Oxford Community Schools Superintendent Tim Throne for the first time detailed the school's response to Crumley's behavior. At the first meeting with the counselor and a staff member, Crumley said shooting sports were a hobby for his family, Throne said. During the second meeting with guidance counselors, Crumley claimed the drawings were part of a video game design and said he wanted to pursue a career in that field, the letter said. According to guidance counselors, Crumley was calm and worked on homework while staff members tried to reach his parents and they traveled to the school. The parents did not notify counselors that they had purchased a gun for their son recently, Throne said. Given the fact that the child had no prior disciplinary infractions, the decision was made he would be returned to the classroom rather than sent home to an empty house, he said. 2022 election. Voting rights take center stage as GOP crafts bills by Nick Corasaniti, the New York Times Company. A new wave of Republican legislation to reshape the nation's electoral system is coming in 2022, as the GOP puts forward proposals ranging from a requirement that ballots be hand-counted in New Hampshire to the creation of a law enforcement unit in Florida to investigate allegations of voting fraud. The Republican drive, motivated in part by a widespread denial of former President Donald Trump's defeat last year, includes voting restrictions and measures that could sow public confusion or undermine confidence in fair elections and will significantly raise the stakes of the 2022 midterms. After passing 33 laws of voting limits in 19 states this year, Republicans in at least 5 states, Florida, Tennessee, South Carolina, Oklahoma, and New Hampshire, have filed bills before the next legislative sessions have even started that seek to restrict voting in some way, including by limiting mail voting. In more than 20 states, more than 245 similar bills put forward this year could be carried into 2022, according to Voting Rights Lab, a group that works to expand access to the ballot. In many places, Democrats largely will be powerless to push back at the state level, where they remain overmatched in Republican-controlled legislatures. GOP state lawmakers across the country have enacted wide-ranging cutbacks to voting access this year and have used aggressive gerrymandering to lock in the party's statehouse power for the next decade. Both parties are preparing to use the issue of voting to energize their bases. Democratic leaders, especially Stacey Abrams, the newly announced candidate for governor of Georgia and a voting rights champion for her party, promised to put the issue front and center. But the left remains short of options, leaving many candidates, voters, and activists worried about the potential impacts in 2022 and beyond, and increasingly frustrated with Democrats' inability to pass federal voting protections in Washington. What we are facing now is a very real and acute case of Democratic subversion, Abrams said in an interview, adding that the country needed a Senate willing to protect our democracy regardless of the partisanship of those who would oppose it. Democrats and voting rights groups say some of the Republican measures will suppress voting, especially by people of color. They warn that other bills will increase the influence of politicians and other partisans in what had been relatively routine election administration. Some measures, they argue, raise the prospect of elections being thrown into chaos or even overturned. Republicans say the bills are needed to preserve what they call election integrity, although electoral fraud remains exceedingly rare in U.S. elections. This is going to be one of the big political issues for at least the next year, said Jason Sneed, executive director of the Honest Elections Project, a conservative group that has helped create voting legislation. He said the group wanted lawmakers to stop thinking of election-related policies as something that only comes up once in a blue moon, adding that it should instead be something that comes up in every legislative session, that you take what you just learned from the last election. Republicans around the country have highlighted polling that shows broad bipartisan support for some voter identification requirements. Jay Ashcroft, Republican Secretary of State of Missouri, has called for the legislature to pass a bill that would require a state or federal photo ID to vote. The idea that the voters in my state are too stupid to follow a simple photo ID requirement like this is ridiculous and ludicrous, he said in an interview. Ashcroft noted that the Missouri bill would not ban people without IDs from voting. They would be allowed to vote provisionally, and their ballots would be validated through signature matching. Weather. Metro area in extreme drought. First Front Range snowfall proves elusive. State gets mostly below average precipitation levels, by Conrad Swanson, the Denver Post. Denver, alongside parts of Adams, Arapahoe, Boulder, Broomfield, Jefferson, and Weld counties, are now considered to be in an extreme drought, according to fresh data from the National Drought Mitigation Center. The center at the University of Nebraska updated Colorado's drought map late last week to indicate that much of the state sank deeper into drought. That means increased wildfire risk and worsening conditions for pasture, cropland, and livestock. We can probably call it a heat wave, Russ Schumacher, a climatologist with Colorado State University and director of the Colorado Climate Center, said. It's much, much above normal for early December, not just in Colorado, but across a big swath of the country. Currently, 38% of the state is in severe drought, and 14.34% of the state is in extreme drought, up from 32% and 8.75% a week earlier, respectively, the drought map shows. The rest of the state varies between moderate drought and abnormally dry. Less than 5% of the state is not classified as in a drought, although those portions are still categorized as abnormally dry. The worsening drought comes as Denver not only continues to set the record for how long the city has gone without its first measurable snow, the previous record was set November 21, 1934, ending the ninth driest November on record. The city is also a little more than a week away from breaking an 1887 record of 235 consecutive days without snow. Plus, the city tied its high temperature for December 1st. Higher temperatures exacerbate the dry conditions, according to Richard Heim, a meteorologist with the National Centers for Environmental Information. "You're getting a lot of evaporation of moisture out of the ground," said Heim, who also authored Colorado's latest drought statistics. Aside from the more immediate risk of wildfires, the worsening drought also means Colorado's snowpack levels are lagging further behind normal levels. Therein lies the bigger concern, Schumacher said. "We should be building up the snowpack right now, but instead we're flat or getting worse," he said. Data collected by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Resources Conservation Service shows that snowpack around Alamosa sits at 36% of normal levels, down 1% from the week before. Snowpack around Durango decreased by the same amount and now sits at 33% of normal levels. Snowpack farther north worsened even more, with levels around Ouray and Gunnison at 53% of normal, down from 61% a week earlier. And snowpack around Aspen and Glenwood Springs is now 63% of normal, down from 72%. Low snowpack levels translate to lower levels of water along the Colorado River. "If I were a water manager, I'd be making plans for some really bad conditions," Heim said. "The drought conditions in Colorado aren't as bad as they were this time last year or during 2002, Heim noted, although he didn't express optimism for the coming weeks. "It's bad, but it has been worse," Heim said. "The not-so-good thing, though, is that it can still get worse." Schumacher said a bit of hope is appearing on the horizon because there's a chance for snow early this week. "They're not going to be big snowstorms or big blockbusters or anything like that, but at least there's a chance," he said. "Then the question is, are we just going to get one or two storms and then is it back to warm and dry? Or is it a pattern shift that takes us back to more of a normal winter?" The scenario is playing out across much of the Rocky Mountains, as far north as Montana, and in the broader western United States, which is experiencing a mega drought. Like the ski resorts in Colorado, areas in Utah also are relying on man-made snow to stay open. Mountain biking, a battle between pedaling and peace, heats up over plans for park in Conifer by John Aguilar, The Denver Post. Byline, Conifer. A titanic battle of Colorado values and priorities is brewing over a proposed mountain bike park on a 9,000-foot mountain overlooking this quiet foothills community 40 minutes from Denver. On one side are the thousands of cyclists who take to the state's roads and trails every day, seeking the thrill and challenge of rolling across world-class terrain and jaw-dropping settings. On the other are longtime mountain residents, adamant about keeping Colorado's relentless growth at bay while protecting a peacefulness and quietude that is increasingly under strain. The battle lines in this face-off are drawn on a heavily wooded 250-acre parcel along Shadow Mountain Drive just west of Conifer, where a plan to build Colorado's first dedicated lift-access mountain bike park with 16 miles of trails and an 830-foot vertical drop spanned by a chairlift has resulted in dueling campaigns for and against it. A Change.org petition in support of the project has gathered nearly 2,500 signatures, while an effort to stymie the plan has gathered about 4,400 signatures. John Lewis, a member of a well-organized group fighting the proposed project, said he and his neighbors are ready for the full send bike ranch proposal to land in front of the Jefferson County Planning Commission. The men behind the project say that it could come as early as next month, with a hope for opening in 2023, should the county give its blessing. Lewis last week pointed to a vast slope of evergreen trees fronted by North Turkey Creek, burbling through a sun-dappled mountain meadow as natural features he doesn't want to see degraded or disturbed by the construction of a downhill mountain bike facility with a 300-space parking lot. He worries about hundreds of vehicles traversing narrow Shadow Mountain Drive every day, negotiating blind curves and racing past driveways to reach the bike park. He worries about impacts to wildlife and the bucolic views he and his neighbors have enjoyed for decades. He also worries about an increase in wildfire danger, a flicked cigarette from a moving car, perhaps, to an area that is already tinder dry. "It's just not appropriate for a residential area," Lewis said, driving his truck several miles up Shadow Mountain Drive and passing dozens of signs denouncing the project. "I don't mind these guys building their bike park, but why here?" Just about the riding. These guys are Jason Evans and Phil Bouchard, longtime friends and bike aficionados from New Hampshire who moved to Colorado last year, just as the pandemic was descending on the state. Bouchard, who describes himself as the strategy side of the full send operation, defends the project as a net gain for the Conifer area. He said he and his business partner will be working with the U.S. Forest Service to do major wildfire mitigation on the site, removing dead and downed trees to make it far safer than it is now. And he said the Full Send Bike Ranch will help draw cyclists off other trails in the area that are currently crowded. "We think the park will alleviate a bit of pressure on a lot of trail systems," Bouchard said. Opponents, he said, have painted the project as an assault on the neighborhood. "But there will be no nighttime operations lit up with bright lights and no plans to have competitions with loudspeakers blaring riders' names and results," Bouchard said. "It's a relatively low-impact recreational development that is closed 6 months of the year," he said. The park, he said, answers an unmet demand from Colorado's avid cycling community. While a number of the state's ski resorts, including Breckenridge, Keystone, and the popular Trestle at Winter Park, offer lift-assisted downhill free-ride mountain bike runs, Bouchard said they are sideshows to their primary ski operations. "It's just about the riding," he said, "of the Full Send Bike Ranch. Full Send would be just over a half hour from the metro area via U.S. 285. And because it's at a lower elevation than the state ski resorts, could be open for more days in the year, with the season extending from April to November. If you want to go mountain biking, you don't have to wait until Saturday and put in a three-hour commute on Interstate 70, Bouchard said. "You could go after work on a Wednesday." Plans also call for a lodge where riders can enjoy a beer after a run. Tickets would be priced at $50 to $80 a day, with season passes available, Bouchard said. The effort to build the park would be a multi-million dollar one, money Bouchard and his partner are confident they can raise if the project is approved by Jefferson County. The friends are working on a lease arrangement with Colorado's State Land Board, which owns the parcel. Gary Moore, executive director of the Colorado Mountain Bike Association, said the Full Send Bike Ranch scratches an itch among the state's earnest peddlers. "They're coming at this from a clean sheet design," he said. "They could really just do what they want to do without facing restraints. There's a huge contingent of mountain bikers on the Front Range that aren't getting access to that style of riding. God's country." But neighbors point to Jefferson County's own Conifer 285 area plan, updated in 2014, which notes that residents value the community's natural environment and rural neighborhoods. Passive and active recreation facilities, including recreational buildings and outdoor multi-use fields, should be designed to respect and be compatible with the area's natural resources, rural character, and adjacent land uses, the document states. That's where the proposed facility falls woefully short, said Todd Jeffries, who serves on the safety committee for the Stop Full Send Bike Ranch Group. Cutting trails through the forest and building a large parking lot near to where North Turkey Creek flows through will have long-lasting negative impacts on the wildlife that call the area home. And what if the project doesn't pencil out in the long term? The land could never be brought back to the condition it was in, Jeffrey said. This place will be permanently scarred. John Patrick, who lives on 10 acres across Shadow Mountain Drive from the proposed bike park, said its mere presence would be enough to drive him from his neighborhood of 38 years. This is God's country, he said, gazing across a meadow to the mountains beyond. We got mountain lions, we got elk, we got bears, we've even had moose. I never thought I'd have to leave, but I'd be moving. In news briefs, one dead, two wounded in Adams County. A homicide investigation is underway after shots were fired early Saturday in Adams County. The incident happened about 1:50 a.m. in the 7900 block of Hollywood Street, according to the Adams County Sheriff's Office. Deputies responding to a report of shots fired found a woman on the street who had been shot several times and a man who had been beaten. Both victims were taken to the University of Colorado Hospital in Aurora to be treated for life-threatening injuries. About 3:30 a.m., two men who had been shot showed up together in a private vehicle at North Suburban Medical Center, a news release said. One man was dead on arrival, and the other had been shot in the hip. A preliminary investigation reveals that the woman who was shot was leaving a gathering at a residence on Hollywood Street, along with the man who was beaten, when a vehicle pulled up, the sheriff's office said. There was a confrontation, perhaps an attempted robbery, the office said. A scuffle ensued and shots were fired. Investigators believe the man who was killed and the man shot in the hip were involved in the Hollywood Street incident. Woman shot dead. Body found in Highlands Ranch. The body of a woman who was shot was found Saturday morning in a retail center parking lot in Highlands Ranch. The Douglas County Sheriff's Office said a victim was found in the area of Park Central Drive and Lucent Boulevard. About 4:10 p.m., the Sheriff's Office announced that the suspect in the shooting had been found dead and that he had apparently taken his own life. The suspect has been located deceased, said Captain Darren Weekly. The homicide victim and the suspect were known to each other, Weekly said. Two men killed in Denver area homicides. Two men were shot and killed in the Denver area overnight Friday into Saturday, one in Aurora and another in Thornton. The Aurora shooting happened in the area of Akron Street and East 14th Avenue, according to police. The victim died at the scene. Police did not release information on a suspect or a motive. Officers responded to the shooting at about 7:45 a.m., a news release said. In Thornton, a man was shot dead in the 10,100 block of Elizabeth Street, police said. The victim, 18-year-old Fernando Perez, was taken to a hospital where he died. No information about a suspect was released. These reports were from Kiernan Nicholson, the Denver Post. At least one dead as volcano erupts in Indonesia, spews ash cloud. Byline, Lumajang, Indonesia. The highest volcano on Indonesia's most densely populated island of Java spewed thick columns of ash, searing gas, and lava down its slopes in a sudden eruption triggered by heavy rain Saturday. At least one villager died from burns and dozens were hospitalized. Mount Semeru's eruption in Lumajang District in East Java Province left several villages blanketed with falling ash. A thunderstorm and days of rain, which had eroded and finally collapsed the lava dome atop the 12,060-foot Semeru, triggered an eruption, said Iko Budi Lalone, who who heads the Geological Survey Center. He said flows of searing gas and lava traveled up to 2,624 feet to a nearby river at least twice Saturday. People were advised to stay 3.1 miles from the crater's mouth, the agency said. Thick columns of ash have turned several villages to darkness, said Lumajang District Head Thorquil Hock. The debris and lava mixed with the rainfall formed thick mud that destroyed the main bridge connecting Lumajang and the neighboring district of Malang, as well as a smaller bridge, Hock said. Indonesia, an archipelago of more than 270 million people, is prone to earthquakes and volcanic activity because it sits along the Pacific Ring of Fire, a horseshoe-shaped series of fault lines. This report was from the Associated Press. Electoral Count Act of 1887. Fearing January 6th repeat, Congress eyes changes, by Luke Broadwater and Nick Corasaniti. The New York Times Company, Byline, Washington. Members of the Select Congressional Committee investigating the January 6th attack at the Capitol are pressing to overhaul the complex and little-known law that former President Donald Trump and his allies tried to use to overturn the 2020 election, arguing that the ambiguity of the statute puts democracy at risk. The push to rewrite the Electoral Count Act of 1887, enacted in the wake of another bitterly disputed presidential election, has taken on new urgency in recent weeks, as more details have emerged about the extent of Trump's plot to exploit its provisions to cling to power. Trump and his allies, using a warped interpretation of the law, sought to persuade Vice President Mike Pence to throw out legitimate results when Congress met in a joint session January 6 to conduct its official count of electoral votes. Pence's refusal to do so led a mob of Trump supporters to chant, "Hang Mike Pence," when they stormed the Capitol, delaying the proceedings as lawmakers fled for their lives. Pence and members of Congress ultimately returned and completed the count, rejecting challenges made by loyalists to Trump and formalizing President Joe Biden's victory. Had Pence done as Trump wanted, or had enough members of Congress voted to sustain the challenges lodged by Trump supporters, the outcome could have been different. We know that we came precariously close to a constitutional crisis because of the confusion in many people's minds that was obviously planted by the former president as to what the Congress's role actually was, said Zach Womp, a former Republican congressman from Tennessee who was a leader of the Reformers Caucus at Issue One, a bipartisan group that is pressing for changes to the election process. Republicans in Congress repeatedly have blocked efforts by Democrats to alter election laws in the wake of the 2020 crisis, and it's not clear whether a bid to revamp the Electoral Count Act will fare any better. But experts have described the law as almost unintelligible, and an overhaul has the support of several leading conservative groups. There are a few of us on the committee who are working to identify proposed reforms that could earn support across the spectrum of liberal to conservative constitutional scholars, said Representative Adam Schiff, Democrat of California, a member of the January 6th committee. We could very well have a problem in a future election that comes down to an interpretation of a very poorly written, ambiguous, and confusing statute. Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming, vice chairwoman of the committee, said Thursday that the 1887 Electoral Count Act is directly at issue and that the panel would recommend changes to it. The Constitution leaves it up to Congress to finalize the results of presidential elections shortly before Inauguration Day. Article 2, Section 1 says, "The President of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives, open all the certificates, and the votes shall then be counted." The process is further detailed in the Electoral Count Act, which says that as lawmakers read through the electoral results of each state during a joint session of Congress, members of the House and Senate may submit objections in writing, which can be sustained if a majority of both chambers approve. Should a state submit multiple slates to Congress, the governor's certified electors would hold, the law says, unless a majority of both chambers voted to reject them. The statute, written in the aftermath of the disputed election of 1876 between Republican Rutherford B. Hayes and Democrat Samuel Tilden, has dictated how Congress formalizes elections, mostly without incident ever since. But what unfolded January 6th tested its limits. Both of the objections by Trump's allies, who sought to invalidate the electoral votes of Pennsylvania and Arizona, failed in the House, although the vast majority of Republicans supported them. In the months since, it has become clear those challenges were part of a broader strategy. John Eastman, a lawyer advising Trump, drafted a plan that included sending to Pence, who presided over the joint session in his role as president of the Senate, a slate of Trump electors from seven states won by Biden. Eastman and other allies of Trump suggested pressuring the vice president to accept the alternate slate of Trump electors, throwing out legitimate votes for Biden. Under such a scenario, Eastman argued, a vote of those states' delegations in the House favoring Republicans could keep Trump in power. Eastman has informed the committee he plans to invoke his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination to avoid answering the group's questions. Senator Chuck Schumer, a Democrat of New York, the majority leader, has indicated an openness to revising the statute, and a small group of senators, including Senator Angus King, an independent from Maine, has been working on potential solutions. A bipartisan coalition of state and local lawmakers is also on board, as are some organizations that study election issues, including Issue 1 and the National Task Force on Election Crises. In documents circulated on Capitol Hill, the task force, which calls the Electoral Count Act severely flawed, proposes several broad changes. The suggestions include limiting the grounds for a lawmaker to object to counting a state's votes and clarifying that the vice president's role in the process is merely ministerial and thus lacking the authority to unilaterally throw out a state's votes. It is also recommended setting clearer time limits for states to choose electors. Trey Grayson, a former Republican Secretary of State of Kentucky, said in an interview that he was concerned that without changes to the law, there would be future attempts to exploit it by both parties. I worry that this is going to become routine because the incentive structure is there, he said. It's really easy for somebody to play to the base, object, know they're going to lose, but reap the rewards of appealing to the base. Those actions hurt our democracy. In further news briefs, CNN fires Chris Cuomo, byline New York. CNN fired anchor Chris Cuomo on Saturday after details emerged about how he assisted his brother, former Governor Andrew Cuomo, as the politician faced sexual harassment allegations this year. The network suspended Chris Cuomo last week to investigate his conduct after New York's Attorney General released details showing he was more involved than previously known in helping to strategize and reach out to other journalists as his brother fought to keep his job. CNN hired a law firm for the review. The firm recommended Chris Cuomo's termination, and CNN chief Jeff Zucker informed the anchor of the decision on Saturday. Edward Shames, last Band of Brothers officer, dies at 99, byline Norfolk, Virginia. Edward Shames, a World War II veteran who was the last surviving officer of Easy Company, which inspired the HBO miniseries and book Band of Brothers, has died. He was 99. Shames was involved in some of the most important battles of World War II. During the war, he was a member of the renowned Easy Company, 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment, 101st Airborne Division. He made his first combat jump into Normandy on D-Day as part of Operation Overload. He volunteered for Operation Pegasus and then fought with Easy Company in Operation Market Garden and the Battle of the Bulge in Bagstogne, according to his obituary. Shames was the first member of the 101st to enter Dachau concentration camp just days after its liberation. When Germany surrendered, Ed and his men of Easy Company entered Hitler's Eagle's Nest, where Ed managed to acquire a few bottles of cognac, a label indicating they were for the Führer's use only. Later, he would use the cognac to toast his oldest son's bar mitzvah, the obituary said. These were from Denver Post Wire Services. COVID-19. Drugstores forced to limit hours due to staff shortages, by Tom Murphy, the Associated Press. A rush of vaccine-seeking customers and staff shortages are squeezing drugstores around the U.S., leading to frazzled workers and temporary pharmacy closures. Drugstores are normally busy this time of year with flu shots and other vaccines, but now pharmacists are doling out a growing number of COVID-19 shots and giving coronavirus tests. The push for shots is expected to grow more intense as President Joe Biden urges vaccinated Americans to get booster shots to combat the emerging Omicron variant. The White House said Thursday that more than 2 in 3 COVID-19 vaccinations are happening at local pharmacies. And pharmacists worry another job might soon be added to their to-do list. If regulators approve antiviral pills from drug makers Merck and Pfizer to treat COVID-19, pharmacists may be able to diagnose infections and prescribe pills to customers. There's crazy increased demand on pharmacies right now, said Teresa Toll, an independent pharmacist who has seen COVID-19 vaccine demand quadruple since the summer at her Sebastian, Florida store. Pharmacists say demand for COVID-19 vaccines started picking up during the summer as the Delta variant spread rapidly. Booster shots and the expansion of vaccine eligibility to include children has since stoked it. On top of that workload and routine prescriptions, many drugstores also have been asking pharmacists to counsel patients more generally on their health or about chronic conditions such as diabetes and high blood pressure. Pharmacies also have been handling more phone calls from customers about vaccines or COVID-19 tests, noted Justin Wilson, who owns 3 independent pharmacies in Oklahoma. We're all working a lot harder than we did before, but we're doing everything we can to take care of people, Wilson said, adding that he has not had to close any of his pharmacies temporarily or limit hours so far. Toll said she was lucky to hire a pharmacy resident just before the Delta surge arrived. The new employee was supposed to focus mostly on diabetes programs, but largely has been relegated to vaccine duty. Toll said her Bay Street pharmacy is now giving about 80 COVID-19 vaccines a day, up from 20 before the Delta wave. God's timing worked out well for me, she said. We would not have gotten through without having that additional person here. Others haven't been as fortunate. A CVS health store on the northeast side of Indianapolis shuttered its pharmacy in the middle of the afternoon Thursday because of staffing issues. A sign taped to the metal gate over the closed pharmacy counter also told customers that the pharmacy soon will start closing for a half hour each afternoon so the pharmacist can have a lunch break. Such temporary closures have ebbed and flowed in pockets around the country throughout the pandemic, but they have grown more acute in recent months, said Ann Burns, a vice president with the American Pharmacists Association. Pharmacies all need minimum staffing to operate safely, and they sometimes have to close temporarily if they fall below those levels. Burns said many pharmacies already had relatively thin staffing levels heading into the pandemic. And a wave of pharmacists and pharmacy technicians left after the virus hit. There's a lot of stress and burnout for individuals who have been going at this since March of 2020, she said. CVS Health spokesman T.J. Crawford said he couldn't comment on the circumstances for one store, but he said his company continues to manage through a workforce shortage that isn't unique to CVS Health. Rival drugstore chain Walgreens also has adjusted pharmacy hours in a limited number of stores, spokesman Fraser Ingerman said. Both companies are hiring. CVS Health says it has hired 23,000 employees from a push it started in September. About half of that total was pharmacy technicians who can deliver vaccines. As companies scramble to hire or keep workers, Burns and Toll worry about adding even more responsibilities, such as diagnosing and treating COVID-19. Toll noted that it is not clear yet how pharmacists will be reimbursed for the time they take to diagnose and prescribe. That will have to be clarified, especially if cases surge again and drugstores need to add even more workers to help. We want to be able to help our community, she said. I don't know how pharmacies are going to manage it. Sherry Brown, a city employee in Omaha, was searching for a vaccine booster dose, but two nearby pharmacies didn't have appointments available, and a third didn't have the brand she wanted. She wound up getting a shot at a county-run clinic Friday. I just wanted to protect myself, said Brown, who suffered through 2 weeks of coughing, headache, and fatigue when she caught the virus in January before she was vaccinated. I guess I'm encouraged to see that people are taking this more seriously. In related news, more Omicron detected. New York announced three more cases of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus Saturday, bringing the number of state cases linked to the new variant to 8. The Omicron variant is here, and as anticipated, we are seeing the beginning of community spread, State Health Commissioner Mary Bassett said in a news release. The number of states finding the variant is growing as well, with authorities in New Jersey, Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Maryland reporting their first confirmed cases Friday, and Missouri reporting its first presumed case. The Omicron variant also has been detected in Nebraska, Minnesota, California, Hawaii, Colorado, and Utah. In New York, 7 of the cases have been found in New York City, once a global epicenter of the pandemic, and the other in Suffolk County. This is from the Associated Press. Colorado Farmers and Hunger Relief, Creating Food Security. Producers team with hunger relief organizations during pandemic to meet increasing demand for produce and grow revenue streams for struggling agricultural businesses, by Taylor Shaw, The Denver Post. When the early days of COVID-19 shut down restaurants and kept Coloradans at home, farmers across the state worried about losing their livelihood as produce piled up at the same time hunger relief organizations faced increasing demands for food. They found solutions to their problems by working together, representatives of Colorado operations on both sides of the equation said. We lost over 60% of our revenue, said Roberto Mesa, co-founder of the 35-acre Emerald Gardens Farm in Bennett. He grows microgreens year-round and operates cooperatively with Sugar Moon Mushrooms, supplying restaurants with fresh produce. At the same time, food insecurity, the inability to access nutritious food, increased in the state by nearly 20%, according to a report by Feeding Colorado, an association of 5 food banks in Colorado. Hunger Free Colorado, a statewide nonprofit organization that addresses food access issues, found even higher rates in its April statewide survey, reporting that 1 in 3 Coloradans is food insecure. For Mesa, a solution for his farm came through partnering with hunger relief organizations. Purchases from food pantries and nonprofit groups came to save our farm, he said. That's when we started to see the potential for innovative local food distribution that was meeting the immediate need and also creating viability for our farmers, Mesa said. Food insecurity in Colorado. The increased need for food assistance related to COVID-19 was felt quickly by many food banks and pantries. Ivan Jackson, executive director of the nonprofit Lift Up, which serves about 3,000 people per month through its food distribution efforts in the Roaring Fork Valley, said that when the pandemic hit, the organization experienced about a 600% increase in food need. I think it's a problem that is not going to go away, Jackson said, citing increased costs of living, gas prices, and grocery items as contributing factors. If COVID continues just as it is at the moment, I see us trying to supply as many people as many food supplies this winter as we did last winter. In addition to hunger and physical health effects, food insecurity has been associated with higher risk of anxiety and depression, a March 2021 BMC Public Health study found. People of color and those with low incomes are more likely to experience food insecurity, according to a 2020 Colorado Health Access survey. I think a common misconception is, I don't know anyone who's food insecure. This doesn't happen in my neighborhood, said Aaron Pulling, president and CEO of Food Bank of the Rockies. Often, it is an invisible challenge. Pulling estimated the Food Bank of the Rockies, which serves Wyoming and 30 Colorado counties, served more than 800,000 people last year and distributed about 110 million pounds of food in its last fiscal year, which ended in June. We've seen a tremendous increase in need, which has not fully subsided. We are still serving more people than we were pre-COVID, Pulling said. One of the primary concerns for Ashley Whelan, Director of Policy at Hunger Free Colorado, is that food insecurity may worsen with the end of the increased government aid that people received during the pandemic. She cited emergency allotments in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program that offered an additional $40 million per month in grocery benefits for families in Colorado. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.
One of the major takeaways from last month's big climate conference in Scotland is all levels of government need to collaborate to address climate change. One small New York community is trying to do just that. Hastings-on-Hudson is 20 miles north of New York City, on the banks of the Hudson River. Due to more frequent extreme weather events, Mayor Nikki Armacost says flooding has become a repeat concern. So the town has adopted a climate emergency declaration, working with Westchester County to reduce greenhouse gases. Armacost says it's critical, even for small towns, to take climate change seriously because it's increasingly becoming something they have to deal with.
Arguably, it's one of the number one concerns of municipalities, big or small, and it's a direction that we should all be moving in. It's really, really important for our children, our children's children, for future generations, that we do whatever we can to address this issue.
She says the village is now working to draft a climate action plan with a focus on sustainable transportation and energy-efficient buildings. As the COP26 climate conference ended, the U.S. branch of the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives released research on realistic pathways local governments can take to reduce per capita emissions by 63% or more by 2030 in order to meet Paris Climate Agreement goals. Angie Fife with the council says one way is through what's known as community choice aggregation, which allows governments to have a say in their local energy supplier.
That's a great way for a city to really lead by example and really demonstrate to the community that they're not only taking action themselves towards local environmental goals, but oftentimes these strategies will reduce the cost of operating city government.
She says Hastings-on-Hudson, which is powered by Sustainable Westchester, is among many New York towns that participate in community choice aggregation. I'm Emily Scott with New York News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado.
Take 2 beers and call me in the morning? Well, scientists now think that some ancient civilizations may have used beer as a source of antibiotics. I'm Jim Metzner, and this is the Pulse of the Planet. Bones recovered from archaeological sites in the Sudan in Africa contain traces of tetracycline, indicating to scientists that Streptomycetes, a bacteria that causes the growth of tetracycline, was consumed by these early Sudanese in 2 of the staples of their diet, bread and beer.
Streptomycetes is a very common soil bacteria. They're storing the grain in mud bins.
George Armelagos is an anthropology professor at Emory University. By researching ancient beer-making recipes, he and his colleagues have been able to reproduce the same kind of beer that people in the Sudan drank more than 2,000 years ago.
Then they would take some of that grain and they would make it into a dough, and they would bake it very hot temperature for a short amount of time. And then they'd take some of the rest of the grain and they would malt it. You lay it out on cloth and you put water on it, and it essentially germinates. And then when that grain germinates, that's releasing the sugars that are essential in the brewing process. So you take that malted grain and you'd grind it up, put it in water for a couple of days, and what happens is the fermentation occurs. So when we talk about this, many of the students think, well, is it like this Buds for You type beer? And it really isn't. What it is it's more of a cereal gruel. It has sort of a sour mash taste to it. And what probably happens is that people drink the beer as essentially a nutrient, and the kids will probably eat what is left on the bottom of the vat. So both the kids and the adults are getting therapeutic doses of tetracycline.
And as we all know, if it was good for you, it wasn't supposed to taste good. To hear about our new CD, please visit pulseplanet.com. Pulse of the Planet is made possible by the National Science Foundation.
AINC programming is brought to you in part by WannaBrands, enhancing customers' lives through the responsible use of cannabis.